see, I say that fewer than one-tenth of the people on the planet have white skin. They are the minority population on the planet. And they are in fear as a minority and being genetic recessive in terms of skin coloration. They are fearful of their genetic annihilation on the planet. But the more they can program the non-white people to hate themselves, then the non-white people end up wanting to be white and supporting the one-tenth white minority and making, dynamically speaking, causing the one-tenth minority to appear more powerful because as non-white people they hate themselves and they're willing to engage in behavior that is self and group destructive. And so it makes the tiny white minority become very powerful because they have programmed the global non-white majority, nine-tenths world majority.
For the first time in a decade, we are getting the most comprehensive look at exactly who is living in the U.S. and where they are living, all 331 million of us. Lisa Desjardins takes a deeper dive into the new data from the U.S. Census Bureau.
Today's census numbers will impact power and policy in this country, and they tell us a lot about what's happening right now and perhaps why. To help us understand, I'm joined by some census all-stars, Hanzi Lo Wong, who covers the census for NPR, and Mark Hugo Lopez, Director of Race and Ethnicity Research at the Pew Research Center. Hanzi, let's start with identity. The census has told us that the population of white Americans is on the decline. Now, those who describe themselves as white only are still the majority. But if you look at the numbers, white Americans who say they're white only, that number went down about 9% in the last 10 years. White only, non-Hispanic. Now, other groups rose. Black only, non-Hispanic, up 5.6%. Asians, non-Hispanic, up about 35.5%, a big leap. And Hispanics saw a similar population boom, 23% increase in their population in the last 10 years. Was this surprising? What do you make of these numbers?
Well, the Census Bureau says this follows the demographic trends that they were expecting based on their estimates and their markers along in the years leading up to a census. And I think the thing to keep in mind here is that the white population, the Census Bureau says, is still the largest racial or ethnic group in the country. And that if you take a look at the data in different ways, it tells you different stories about the white population. Yes, the Census Bureau says if you take a look at the number of people who just checked off the white box when answering the race question, that share has declined over the past decade. But if you take a look at the number of people who checked off the white box, as well as other, at least one other racial category, that share has increased more than 300%. So this is telling us that over the past decade, more and more people living in the United States are choosing to report that they identify with more than one racial group.
Martha, let's talk about that specifically. I want to look at the numbers that Hanzi's mentioning here, some other numbers indeed. When the Census Bureau grouped together those who say they are a race other than those described on the form or multiple races, let's look at the data that we saw today from that. That is now the second largest racial identity, essentially either multiracial or another race. And that we saw that group go up 129% across all races. What is this telling us about America today and how people identify?
Well, there's many things that are happening here. Intermarriage rates, for example, have been rising over the last few decades. We've seen, for example, among Hispanics, 24% of newlywed Hispanics marry somebody who's not Hispanic. About 27% of newlywed Asian Americans marry somebody who's not Hispanic. And oftentimes, the person who is that spouse is somebody who is white, non-Hispanic. And so when we take a look at these numbers, the 33.8 million people who marked two or more races, which, by the way, is a large increase over 2010, when about 10 million people did the same, what we're seeing is more and more Americans are identifying multiple races as part of their identity. The Census Bureau will say that that's partly a reflection of the better way that they ask the question about racial and ethnic identity. But as you may have seen on TV, many people are searching and trying to understand their ancestry and their roots by doing DNA tests and so forth. But all of that speaks to me by saying that it looks like Americans are trying to understand where they're from, including claiming many of the different roots that they have in their background. And we saw some of that data today in the Census Bureau release.
Hansi, Mark just raised a good point. A lot depends on the question you ask. And the fact that the second largest racial group in this country is composed of people who either said they were other, not on the form, or multiracial, what does that say about data and a possible data problem for the census? And also, they had other issues. What do we know about the accuracy of this data coming out of 2020?
You know, the 2020 census was a hot mess. And one thing that didn't happen with the 2020 census was the race and ethnicity question was supposed to look very different for the 2020 census, according to the Census Bureau's original plans. Census Bureau did years of research to try to address the issue that increasingly more people in recent censuses have elected some other race as their option when trying to answer the race question. The Census Bureau's research shows that a lot of folks who do check off that box, some other race, identify as Hispanic or Latino. And so the Census Bureau tried to address that, tried to change the way it asked that question. But during the Trump administration, the White House's Office of Management and Budget didn't make policy changes that were proposed, essentially didn't make any action on those proposals, forced the Census Bureau to move ahead, to have to print out those paper census forms, get the census ready to go. And so the Census Bureau had to rely on a different kind of question that they were planning to use. And now we have here, you know, the second largest racial group, according to the 2020 census, is some other race. That is a data problem because it is not very specific. And it includes a lot of folks who are essentially in one way saying this question doesn't really reflect the way I see my identity.
In the last couple of minutes that we have here, I want to also talk about another issue of identity, which is geographic and population loss across the country. This is a map that the Census Bureau put up today. The brown spots are counties that have lost population in the last 10 years. That is much of the country, and cities are the places that are seeing some growth. I want to ask both of you what you think these trends mean for our politics right now, our sharp divide, and the huge redistricting fight up ahead. First Mark, then you, Hansi.
Well, as the Census Bureau noted today, a lot of these changes are people moving to metropolitan areas. So, as you noted, suburbs and cities have seen some fast growth, or at least more growth in the last 10 years than rural parts of the country. Now, this is a trend that's been going on for 20 plus years, 30 years. But it is interesting that when you take a look at this, some of the fastest growing places are suburbs and also cities. The District of Columbia, I think, is really one good example of a place that was declining in the 1990s in terms of population, but is now one of the faster growing parts of the country in terms of a city. This could have some implications for redistricting because as a population has shifted towards urban areas and suburban areas, that may lead to some different drawings of redistricting maps. We'll have to see what happens, but that is one potential implication for this change.
How big is this in redistricting and just voting rights and overall, Hansi?
You know, I think we have to remember the data out today, the main purpose of it is to redraw voting districts. And this data is coming out more than 4 months late. And a lot of state lawmakers, redistricting commissions know that, have been aware of that. And some of them are under a lot of pressure to meet legal deadlines to draft voting maps. You know, some state and local governments have already pushed back upcoming election dates because they didn't have this data that's out now. And so it is a rush to get maps drawn. And also it's going to be a lot of pressure to make sure these maps are drawn fairly because of all this chaos now with these delays. We'll have to see how redistricting, which is usually a very messy process, this is likely to be an even more contentious process with this data delay.
You help us understand this important mess. The Census All-Stars, Hansi Lo Wong, Mark Hugo Lopez. Thank you both.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
This the city of Chicago.
Black babies cost less.
When the pandemic-related shutdowns first started a year and a half ago, some people longed for social interactions and missed getting together with loved ones. Others going through fertility treatments saw their hopes of having a baby crumble. Fertility clinics weren't considered essential, and now, as doctors cautiously reopen, they're seeing the return of old patients and a long list of new ones, as WBEZ's Araceli Gomez-Aldana has the story.
On March 17, 2020, the American Society for Reproductive Medicine sent out the memo: no more fertility treatments, indefinitely. Dr. Kara Goldman is an infertility specialist and heads fertility preservation at Northwestern Memorial Hospital. She remembers exactly what she was doing when she got the news.
That Sunday, I recalled transferring an embryo to a patient and, you know, having this really tough conversation about, you know, if she does get pregnant, what does that mean for the health of her pregnancy? But if she doesn't pursue her embryo transfer, when will she be able to? These were really, really hard questions.
Goldman says there have been a lot of unknowns during the pandemic, how COVID could affect a pregnancy, how to keep her staff safe. But most importantly, she was worried about her patients' mental health.
And to have that rug pulled out from under them, that not only do they need to rely on assisted reproduction, but they can't because we can't offer that care, is absolutely devastating.
Fertility treatments were shut down for months. Doctors only continued working with cancer patients. All others were left in limbo, regardless of their age or where they were in their treatment cycle. And for women whose age was a big factor in their fertility journey, time was of the essence because, in their situation, it could be now or never. Goldman says the hardest part in those early days was not knowing how long it would last. And now, as Goldman reflects, she thinks a lot about how fertility treatment wasn't deemed essential.
And I think that there's always this misconception that infertility somehow is a luxury, like to be treated for infertility is a luxury. Infertility is a disease of certain socioeconomic groups, and it's not. It does not discriminate. So the first part of that is that infertility care is essential, and it's never elective.
Infertility is a medical disease. Treatments range from intrauterine insemination and in vitro fertilization to fertility preservation like embryo or egg freezing. And they all come with a hefty price tag. According to the American Society for Reproductive Medicine, the average cost of an IVF treatment in the U.S. is more than $12,000. Many patients require several rounds of treatment before getting pregnant. Some state laws require medical insurance cover the costs, diagnosis, and treatment of infertility. Illinois is one of those states. Goldman says as restrictions lifted, they began accepting patients.
Ultrasounds in the morning, when they come in for their monitoring, kind of through their IVF cycle.
And patients are rushing back to fertility clinics. The demand is high.
You know, needing to get in as soon as possible because they had been delayed, feeling this sense of I need to make sure I get my IVF cycles in now because I may lose my insurance, because I may lose my job. And then I think long term, I'm seeing a lot of patients who are rethinking their whole future of family planning.
One of those patients was Kristen Field.
I am a patient of Dr. Kara Goldman's. I'm also the executive director of Friends Apprentice, which supports research in all areas of women's health in the Northwestern Apprentice medical community.
Before the pandemic, she was okay with waiting. She just got a new job. She just turned 36, and time was still on her side. But something changed.
There's something that made me really think about the idea of a partner and the idea of having a family, and that they didn't necessarily have to be fully exclusive together, and that someone leading a women's health organization made me think about, wait, my women's health and like how am I taking care of myself?
Field began her fertility preservation treatment with Dr. Goldman in January. The process took 6 months. She paid about $12,000 out of pocket. And as she got started, Field decided to document her fertility preservation journey on social media.
Here we are, day two. I will be icing my stomach before we do the shots, and I won't film.
Day three of my egg cryopreservation journey.
Good morning.
What surprised Field the most was how much she learned about her body and women's reproductive health in general, things you don't learn about in high school.
You know, I wish, you know, when we were younger, that it just was talked about this way. That it's not part of your overall holistic health care. I want to know about how my body works. And this whole experience, I wanted other women to know those things, to be empowered around their own health, whatever decisions they make.
But it's not just about her health and how her body works. It's the societal pressures she says she felt as a woman. She wishes the conversations around fertility and family were different.
did you ever want to have a family? What would that look like for you? Or, you know, is partner important to you? Do you want to have a child on your own? Like, some of those bigger questions.
Field says the lack of awareness around fertility treatment was one of the reasons she documented and publicly shared what she went through. By sharing her own story and putting herself out there, she was hoping that would make others feel safe to do the same.
I just commend all the women warriors who have shared their personal stories with me, because I know it just opens up all of us to be more open about women's health.
Field now has a journal called Possibility. She says going through fertility preservation gave her a possibility she didn't know existed. And she says it all began with her being vulnerable and having an honest conversation with Dr. Goldman. Field says that conversation doesn't have to be scary. Instead, learning about your own health can be empowering and essential. Araceli Gomez Aldana, WBEZ News.
And it was hot. It was so hot. It was like 95, 100 degrees in the shade. The wind never blew.
And they say that New Orleans has humidity down there, which kind of cools us off. That's bullshit. It was death heat.
Inside the convention center, it was so stifling hot, people tried to stay outside.
Hot as hell, 100-something degrees.
It's hot.
It was very, very hot at that time. It was 97, 98 degrees.
It was hot.
The heat radiating off of the highway at night was intensely hot.
It's hot as hell.
That was the worst summer. I mean, that heat was ridiculous.
Man, hot as heck in here.
It was beyond Africa heat. If Africa heat was anything like that, like I said before, and I'll say it again, they keep saying go back to Africa. Hell no.
Extreme temperatures will become more frequent and more severe as climate change worsens. But these temperatures are not experienced the same way, even within the same city. Low-income communities of color in urban areas are more likely to experience extreme heat because of historically unequal policies and investment around development and zoning. A new national effort hopes to identify and eventually address these urban heat islands. WUNC environment reporter Celeste Gracia reports.
It's a late July evening, and Tobin Freed is standing in front of a table in the parking lot of the Scrap Exchange in Durham. The table, draped in a blue tablecloth, is covered with papers, equipment, and a box of pastries. Despite a long day of organizing, she's upbeat as she helps volunteers check in and explain their assignments to them.
Here, this is where you're going to start.
Okay.
Get in Google and go there.
Okay.
You want to be there by 7.
The assignments are simple, but different. Dozens of volunteers head out on 25 different routes throughout Raleigh and Durham at 3 separate times over the course of one day. Volunteers either bike, walk, or drive. They take sensors with them that measure heat stress index. Freed is the sustainability manager for Durham County. She explains that data from the sensors will be used to create heat maps of the two cities.
So then we get to see where these urban heat islands, these little pockets that are hotter than other areas or that don't cool off later in the day, where they are exactly. And so then we can start designing programs and policies to address this. So is it an area where we can plant more trees or put in more green space?
The data can also be used to address other issues within a city. Nicole Goddard is a sustainability analyst for the city of Raleigh.
Our transportation office may use it to think about where they might put covered bus shelters. Our parks department might use that to think about parks acquisition projects or even parks amenities.
While all of these ideas may help in the future, officials are now dealing with this uneven distribution of heat because of decisions made decades ago about where people could live.
So both Raleigh and Durham have a really painful history and legacy of racist policy and planning that served to segregate both cities based off of race.
Max Colley is a program manager at the Durham Museum of Life and Science and a lead organizer of this project.
These redlined areas, the areas that were given the lowest grade because specifically they had the most people of color and black people in them, today are most likely most at risk during a heat event.
Colley says these neighborhoods tend to have much higher levels of impervious surfaces. People in these communities are also more likely to live in poverty and not have health insurance.
Data that comes out of this project, once again, we hope will shine a light on that and help to make better decisions to right some of those wrongs.
Okay.
Gear Street. We're going to stay here for 1.5 miles. And then
back in Durham, I drove around for an hour and a half with Marla Casper, a volunteer who lives in Cary. We went up and down several streets throughout East Durham, passing by houses in quiet neighborhoods to getting stuck in traffic in busy shopping areas. We followed a map of our route that had detailed instructions on where to turn. The entire time, our heat sensor stayed attached to the passenger side window. Casper says she feels like being on the data collection side of research is really important.
You know, not only as a nurse or a medical professional, but just as a community member and giving back to the community, this is going to be used for good. It's really exciting.
Raleigh and Durham participated in this national program along with New York City, San Diego, and parts of Indiana, among other places across the country. Analytical company Kappa Strategies in Portland will analyze the data that was collected. Then the final heat maps will be sent back to Raleigh and Durham in a few months, and that's when the real work will start. Celeste Gracia, North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC.
Also, allow me to apologize to other families formed through transracial adoption because I am deeply sorry that we suggested that interracial families are in any way funny or deserving of ridicule.
All right, time for StoryCorps. Libby Storick wanted to talk to her grandpa about his life, but her granddad, Harry Golomsky, is 97 years old, and he started losing his memory. So Libby went to StoryCorps by herself and talked about being adopted and growing up in rural Wisconsin.
It was a very tight-knit community, not very diverse, and also I am Black, and my family is white. I was asked many times if I was like an exchange student or if we were at church, some little kid would be turning around in the pew just staring at me for most of the service. But the memories with my grandfather, they are just like 100% good memories. He kind of reminded me of a gentle giant towering over everybody else. Being a farmer, he was used to waking up with the sunrise. I would get up and we would quietly go into the kitchen and he would always give me some milk and sugar with a tiny bit of coffee mixed in. And he had a rocking chair and I'd climb up on his lap with my coffee. And for a half hour or so, we'd rock and we would watch the birds. Nobody else got to spend that time with him. He doesn't remember me now. And it's hard to see him like that. If I could ask him something now, I think I would probably ask him what his secret was. Because he always seemed so grateful for living. You don't get that from a lot of adults, you know? It seemed like it came easy to him, and maybe that's just from a whole lifetime of practicing to find that joy and that happiness in the little things. That is something that I strive for as an adult. At the end, all any of us really want is to be remembered for our best selves.
Libby Stroik for StoryCorps in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. That interview is archived at the American Folklife Center at the Library of Congress.
Mr. Doe, going on in your country right now in Vietnam is 4,000 little kids who are in quarantine camps away from their parents because of this fake scamdemic. And you come to my country and you act like one of these communist parasites? I ask you to go the f*** back to Vietnam!
We've seen a dramatic increase in the number of hate crimes directed toward Asian Americans over the past 2 years, but we haven't heard a lot from the victims until now. Kyle Chang has the story of a Japanese American teacher who was attacked in Seattle earlier this year and has more on how that event changed her life.
Noriko Nasu is 44 years old. She was born in Japan and she now teaches Japanese to high school students in the North Shore School District. Travel and hiking are a big part of her life. Every year, she takes her language students to visit Japan. One year, they decided to climb Mount Fuji.
It's a serious mountain. I mean, it's as high as Mount Adams in Washington State. So, like, we need to train.
So every weekend, rain or shine, or snow, Nasu trained with students on local trails. And even though there was a typhoon raging when they arrived, she and her students made it to the summit. The school community was shocked by what happened to Nasu in late February. As she was parking in the International District in Seattle, she noticed a guy across the street.
He looked at me, and he just basically kept staring at me.
Nasu parked her car, and she says the man crossed the street somewhere behind her. Her boyfriend came outside to meet her, and they were taking something out of the car when she was attacked.
And I just felt this huge impact on my face. I heard this noise, something hit my bones on my face. And then next thing, I was on the ground. All I could feel was my mask was filling up with blood. And I couldn't breathe because it was full of blood. I was just thinking, why am I bleeding and why are my teeth broken?
Her boyfriend, who is white, confronted the attacker, at which point he was also assaulted. Nasu suffered a fractured nose, broken teeth, and a concussion. Her boyfriend also had a concussion and needed 8 stitches. At first, they believed the attack was an attempted robbery, but then they saw footage from a nearby security camera.
We could see the guy was closer to my boyfriend, but he avoided him, went around him to hit me. And after I went down, you could see in the video he was going to walk away. He came back just because my boyfriend started yelling at him.
That's why Nasu thinks this was a hate crime directed against her, because she's Asian. Sean Holdip, a 41-year-old former EMT in New York, was arrested 1 week after the incident. He was charged with 2 counts of assault. Prosecutors said they didn't have the evidence to charge him with the hate crime. He is now in King County Jail awaiting trial. After the attack, Nasu's community rallied around her. Dentists offered free teeth repairs. Students sent cards and flowers. Her colleagues organized a meal train.
There are people who I've never even heard of are coming by and drop me dinner, which is, I think, amazing.
Many of Nasu's physical wounds have now healed, but she still suffers from neurological symptoms, like extreme fatigue, and she gets migraines and dizziness when she looks at bright lights. She's had to cancel a planned hike of the Wonderland Trail this year, and on doctor's orders, she won't be teaching in the fall. But she's staying positive.
A lot of people say, like, I hope you don't lose faith in humanity. But I feel like this experience actually made me realize there's a lot to appreciate. It actually helped me restore faith in humanity in a way. You just don't know how loved you are, how important you are to other people. I think it's easy to fall under this way of thinking, like, they don't like me, or they don't want me here, they hate me. But it's just this one person. Don't let this experience define your life.
Nasu says she will do the Wonderland Trail, and she will climb Mount Rainier someday. Maybe not this year, but she says the mountains are not going to go away. For KUOW News, I'm Kyle Chang.
Why haven't you learned anything?
After the discovery of mass graves of Indigenous students in Canada, Interior Secretary Deb Haaland announced an investigation of Indian boarding schools in the U.S. Students of one such government-funded school in Nevada say that inquiry couldn't come soon enough. From member station KNPR, Bert Johnson explains.
If you visit the old Stewart Indian School in Carson City, Nevada, with Linda Eben-Jones, she can tell you where students used to line up at mealtimes and the kinds of stones used to make the buildings.
When I first came here, I was in this dorm here, and it goes in a big U, and there was hundreds of girls in there. There were bunk beds all the way around.
Jones is a member of the Paiute tribe, who graduated from Stewart back in 1966. She first came here when she was 15 because her mother was terminally ill.
I think if I would have known the truth, I may not have come here, but I did come.
Jones says the truth of daily life at Stewart was strict and abusive. She remembers one teacher who was especially cruel.
He'd say, "Did you do your homework?" And I'd say, "Yeah, I did." Or he wouldn't even let you answer. He'd just hit you anyway. And he said, "Well, that's okay."
The school closed in 1980. But over the course of its 90-year history, more than 30,000 Indigenous children came to Stewart. Andrea Big Goose was also here in the 1960s.
At night, it was a sad, scary place to be because there was so much pain that you could feel.
Big Goose is an elder from the Washoe tribe of Nevada and California. Many of her relatives went to boarding schools too, including a great-grandfather who was sent to Carlisle Industrial School in Pennsylvania. Back then, the federal government sent Native children as far from their families as possible.
This country has to realize what they did is not right, and they have to come to terms with it and realize that the truth needs to come out. The truth needs to be told.
The truth of the harm caused by off-reservation boarding schools, says William Bauer, goes beyond individual abuses. He's a history professor at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, and an enrolled citizen of the Round Valley Reservation in Northern California. The Native population dropped by about 11,000 people in the decade after Stewart was founded.
The American Indian population hits its lowest point in 1900, with about 225 to 250,000 people counted on the U.S. Census.
Bauer says depopulation was part of the plan.
Their deliberate attempts to eliminate and erase indigenous peoples from North America with the ultimate goal, right, of acquiring indigenous peoples' land.
According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Native Americans suffer the highest suicide rate of any group in the United States. Koo Stevens believes that epidemic of self-harm is part of the boarding school legacy. Stevens is a member of the Yerington Paiute tribe. His great-grandfather escaped from Stewart Indian School three different times.
I feel like historical trauma plays a huge part because some people just can't live with it.
Stevens welcomes the federal investigation, even if what it reveals is painful.
Because I want people to know what we've been through to better understand how we could be helped.
The findings of the investigation will be sent to Interior Secretary Holland in April.
I think this is it. I think.
Back at Stewart Indian School in Carson City, there's another part of the campus that lies across the road from the old dorms, the school cemetery. Bernadette Nieto serves on the Washoe tribe's burial committee and thinks of those children often.
A lot of them just stopped eating and stopped trying to live and like literally died from broken hearts because they were taken away from their family.
She says the tribe isn't even sure how many people are buried within the cemetery.
What I expect is to actually prove, you know, the rumors, the things that everybody was told when they were little and growing up, that, you know, yes, there are more graves out here, like outside of the fence.
If federal officials get permission to scan the ground, they could find many more unmarked graves. For NPR News, I'm Bert Johnson in Carson City, Nevada.
Tennessee.
There's a new 11-page document that every teacher in Tennessee must now study. It's titled Prohibited Concepts in Instruction. It's how the Tennessee Department of Education proposes to enact a new state law that limits how teachers address race, sex, and privilege at school. And under these new rules, teachers who have been deemed to have taught these banned concepts could face disciplinary action, including losing their licenses, and school districts could face up to $5 million in fines. Joining us now to talk about all this is Beth Brown, the president of the Tennessee Education Association. Welcome.
Hi.
Hi. So what counts as teaching any of these concepts? Like, is the mere mention of, say, structural racism prohibited, or the mere mention of a concept like white privilege? Are those totally banned now?
Well, that's part of the problem with the law, in that it is very vague, it's very subjective, it's very unclear, because there are so many questions about what can I say, what can I do in my delivery of the Tennessee state standards, which is what guides instruction in Tennessee's public school classrooms. And so I can't answer that. Tennessee's educators can't answer that because it's not clear either in the law or in the guidance issued by the Department of Education.
And how have other teachers been reacting to these new rules? Like, what are you hearing so far?
As I travel the state and have conversations with educators, particularly educators who teach social studies or who teach language arts like I did in the classroom, and when I taught the Declaration of Independence and who wasn't included at the time, and, you know, at what point would I be in danger of violating this new law? And so there are a lot of educators who want to do their job, want to do it well, but are very concerned about just the vague subjective language of this new law inhibiting their ability to perform their job with fidelity.
Can I just pick up from the Declaration of Independence? Like, if you were to teach that under these new rules, how do you see that playing out in your classroom?
Well, I'm thinking about the very last time that I taught it in the classroom. And, you know, as a class of high school juniors, you know, these are young adults who are, you know, they're critical thinkers, and they can explore who wasn't included and how has it changed. And, you know, I also, as you know, part of the standards is when you teach that is you have to teach teach them to analyze the structure of the document itself. And so someone might have been offended or angry that that conversation was taking place in my classroom.
Well, what recourse or protection might a teacher have if they have been accused of teaching something that's banned under this new law?
A parent has up to 30 days to file a complaint. The district conducts an investigation. If the complainant does not like the outcome of the investigation, they have the ability to appeal it to the Department of Education, and then the Department of Education will conduct its own investigation and make a final determination.
What would you like the public to know, to understand about these new rules? Like, what is your message to the community?
There is no group of individuals more passionate and committed to ensuring that Tennessee students continue to receive a high quality and well-rounded education. We're committed to teaching the facts. We take great pride in our professional integrity. This law is a disservice to our students because as part of that well-rounded education, we have to have conversations about difficult but important topics. We will continue to do what we have always done, which is to teach the Tennessee State Standards with fidelity.
Beth Brown is president of the Tennessee Education Association. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And we should note that we did reach out to Penny Schwinn, Tennessee's education commissioner, and she declined our interview request.
Billie Holiday, I sing your blues. Bet your life against me and I swear to God you'll lose it. Motherfuck the cops, we still singing for St. Louis. Motherfuck the cops, we still singing for St. Louis. Motherfuck the cops, we still singing for St. Louis.
It's been 7 years since Michael Brown Jr. was shot and killed by then Ferguson police officer Darren Wilson. Since then, his father, Michael Brown Sr., and stepmom, Cal Brown, have been working to preserve his legacy through the Michael Brown Chosen for Change Foundation. St. Louis Public Radio's Marissa Ann Lewis-Thompson spoke with Cal and Michael about their son's legacy in the year following the murder of George Floyd and how their family is working to heal.
I'm definitely in a place where working on coping and understanding the coping process and trying to move forward for the rest of my family. The family is really still in disbelief and still have questions and still don't understand why this happened, especially the little ones. But we just keep them encouraged and keep the fight alive.
You were hopeful that the officer who killed your son would be held accountable with a new prosecutor in place. That didn't happen. Are you still hopeful that accountability and justice will happen at some point?
Of course. I'm working on a few things right now. Sending some rooms to try to get some laws in our favor as being black folks, brown folks, you know. So that's definitely still on the table. That will never get wiped off the table. Hopefully, if not with this prosecutor later on in the future, this can be brought back up because there's no statutory on murder. I'm going to ride this to my death. So whatever work I have to do to try to bring this back to the light, I'm going to do it.
What does accountability and justice look like for you at this moment?
Darren Wilson spending the rest of his life in jail. It wouldn't necessarily be justice, but it would be accountability for taking Mike's life.
What about you, Mike?
Be honest.
Death penalty. Accountability, of course. I feel like this person should not be walking around hugging his family, waking up to his family, and being able to live a regular life while we over here hurting, like this incident never happened.
Last year, with the murder of George Floyd, it was a big turning point in the conversation surrounding police violence, accountability, defunding the police. Where do you see this conversation going, and who should be leading it?
Well, everybody keep talking about justice. Justice would mean our children would still be alive. Thankfully, this cop is being held accountable to some extent for his actions. I would say the families have to lead this conversation. It's not a movement without the family's voice being first and foremost.
I feel about the same way. It's a big thing for their family to know that their loved one got justice. Sadly, their loved one is still gone. You know, we had conversations with other people when they were asking us, how do I think that the families feel? I can only speak for myself. It's still not satisfying. You know, we still shouldn't have to go through this. This should not even happen.
So much has happened in the past 7 years. As people reflect on that time, what do you want your son's legacy to be as the conversation surrounding police violence and accountability continues?
So many things have changed, so many different laws, so many policies. They're told to wear body cams, and officers are beginning to be held, you know, accountable. So I think we want him to be remembered as the change agent, the person who lit the fire and it went wild. Because if you think about it, there wouldn't have been a George Floyd, a Breonna Taylor, a Ahmaud Arbery, a Dante Wright, and sadly the list goes on, if Mike Brown Jr. had not been murdered on August 9th, 2014 and laid in the street for 4.5 hours.
What do you hope for your son's legacy, Mike?
Just for people not to forget. Some people will not forget. You got people that go on with their life and forget the story or what happened that day, you know, but just the truth.
That was Michael Brown Sr. and his wife, Cal Brown, co-founders of the Michael Brown Chosen for Change Foundation, speaking with St. Louis Public Radio's Marissa Ann Lewis-Thompson.
Now, fake IDs aren't rare among college students, you know, to get into bars or nightclubs when you're under 21. But this year, some students have their sights set on a new forged document, fake vaccination cards. Colleges and universities across the country are now requiring proof of COVID-19 vaccines to attend in-person classes. And that has led to a growing market for fake vaccination cards for people who are hesitant or just unwilling to get vaccinated. We're joined now by Rosalyn Romero of the Associated Press, who's reported on how students are obtaining these fake vaccination records and what colleges are doing to respond. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
So first, what types of records are schools accepting as even proof of vaccinations?
I should preface this by saying that I myself am a college student. So I go to California Polytechnic University in San Luis Obispo. And I think it's for all of the 23 campuses in the California State University system where students simply have to upload a photo of their vaccination card. So it's all submitted through photos on the student's portal.
I'm just curious how you first got the idea to report on a story about fake vaccination cards. You say that you're currently a college student. Did you actually come across some fake vaccination cards or hear some of your classmates talking about trying to get one?
I haven't seen one in person, but before I even started reporting on this story, on my personal Instagram account, someone had followed me, and the username was NHS_vaccine cards. They were selling these vaccine cards. And then when I started, you know, having some more conversations with my peers in college, there were some people who said, yeah, they're actually really easy to obtain. Not only that, but social media has, for example, like the app Snapchat, since your posts are only up for 24 hours, it's very easy to get away unless people screenshot your listing. Right. And so we're seeing people, you know, put on their Instagram or their Snapchat stories, I'm selling vaccine cards for anywhere between $20 to $200 a piece.
$200? Wow. And we should note that using a fake vaccination card in order to attend in-person classes at a university or college. That's a federal crime, right?
So the Department of Health and Human Services Office of the Inspector General, as well as the FBI, released a statement earlier in March 30th of this year, basically stating that if you produce, if you sell, if you use any, even if you just possess a forged vaccine card, it is a federal crime and you could face possible fines and a maximum of 5 years in prison.
Yeah, I was just going to say, how do they know if they have run into fake vaccination cards? What exactly is the verification process?
So it's one of the questions that I'm trying to figure out is, well, do these colleges and universities have access to a central database or a state database that has all of the COVID-19 vaccinations on record? And can those universities compare the vaccine cards they're receiving with the data that's already there?
Right.
And so far right now, we know that the CDC does not have a national database of COVID-19 vaccines.
Right.
So we're not really sure what this verification process even looks like with these cards.
Wait, so just in terms of verifying, like there is a lot number on my vaccination card. I'm looking at it right now. Couldn't a college or university just cross-reference whatever lot number they see on a card or a photo of a card that's submitted and cross-reference it to some database to make sure that lot number exists?
So we don't know if these universities and colleges have access to any database for these vaccine lot numbers, but what I did notice among sellers on the dark web, on social media, their listings say, we work with a doctor or a health professional who puts in these vaccine lot numbers for customers to make it seem like they are fully vaccinated.
So interesting. Rosalyn Romero of the Associated Press, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
White supremacy is the sickness.
The emergence of the Delta variant of COVID-19 is fueling a spike in new cases of the virus, especially in Black, Latino, and Indigenous communities. An aptly timed documentary film called Trusted Messenger focuses on vaccine hesitancy in these vulnerable populations. The film, which is showing tomorrow at the Riverview Theater in Minneapolis, highlights efforts of community-based healthcare professionals who work to convince people to protect themselves from the deadly virus. Reham Fashir has more.
When vaccines were still in the trial stage last year, Chris Newberry was already hearing stories that some people didn't want the shots. On top of that, a trend started to emerge about certain demographics.
I kind of assumed that it was going to be maybe like a 30-minute documentary about healthcare professionals talking about how important it is to get the vaccine. And that is certainly in the film. But as I followed the stories, it turned into something more.
The more Newberry followed healthcare professionals around, the more stories he gathered about why people of color and Native American people were hesitant to get the vaccine. He interviewed folks in Minneapolis, Owatonna, and Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe.
I grew up in North Minneapolis. I'm African American, so working on health equity and issues of, for example, vaccination.
People really talked about the historical trauma that the Tuskegee experiment has caused. For several decades, Black people were left untreated from syphilis as part of the study, even after a drug was approved. Kelly Robinson is a nurse and president of Black Nurses Rock, Twin Cities chapter. The film documents her efforts to convince people to get the vaccine. Robinson says many in the community have underlying health conditions that could make a COVID diagnosis severe.
We are living in a time that's like no other. To be in it and to live through it and to see the numbers in terms of deaths, it's one of those things where in my moments, it's painful.
Recent data from the Minnesota Department of Health show new cases are rising among Black Minnesotans at a much higher rate than for other racial groups. Immigrant communities also have unique vulnerabilities to the virus. Some unauthorized immigrants don't have insurance or the language skills to ask questions. Some are also at higher risks of contracting the disease because of their work. The film also highlights the efforts of healthcare workers who provide accurate information about the vaccine. They are the trusted messengers. Iris De La Rosa is a nurse who works for Tri-Valley Opportunity Council's Migrant Head Start program. She says some people originally from Central America don't question the vaccine because they're used to getting shots as children. But others, who've never had the opportunity to access healthcare, tell her they don't see the point. De La Rosa says some are against it for religious reasons, and others feel like they have natural immunity.
What I see a lot in the Hispanic community is just like the waiting game. Like, well, I'm going to wait to see what happens to the people when they get vaccinated, you know? I don't know. It's just a lot of mistrust.
Chris Newberry, the filmmaker, says he hopes the documentary inspires more people beyond the healthcare profession to connect with their communities and become trusted messengers as well.
It's a story about vaccine hesitancy, but it's mostly about the people doing the work to turn the tide.
By inspiring more trusted messengers, his ultimate goal is that several months from now, the country would have reached herd immunity and that the film would have played a small role in getting there. Reham Fashir, NPR News, Minneapolis.
In 2018, at the New York State Democratic Convention, Governor Andrew Cuomo said this.
Sexual harassment of women is real, it is undeniable, and this is the moment in history to make the reform and end it once and for all. And New York is going to be the state to do it. It ends here and it ends now.
Cringeworthy now, maybe, right? But was he being prescient? Is his resignation a sign that Me Too has staying power? To talk about Me Too, Andrew Cuomo, women and power, we're going to put this story into national, maybe even global context. Let's hear from Rebecca Traister, writer-at-large for New York Magazine and author of the book Good and Mad, The Revolutionary Power of Women's Anger. Hi, Rebecca. Welcome back.
Hi, Brian. It's good to be here.
So your focus on Governor Cuomo has been on power and how he uses it, how what you call the theatrics of dominance kept him in power. Can you describe what you mean by theatrics of dominance?
Yeah, there's a thing that Andrew Cuomo is great at, and it is performing authority, right? And we can think of the sort of ways he's done it well, right? Performing competence, like in the news conferences through COVID that won him an Emmy, you know, and that people loved and felt comforted by. He would get up there and he would perform confidence and he was in control. And that's sort of the prettiest version of this, right? It was comforting to a lot of people. Now, what we later learn, and the reason that I emphasize the word performance there, is that in fact, the state was in many ways mismanaging, underreporting the number of deaths in nursing homes. His top aides, as was revealed in a different report that came out of the Attorney General Tish James' office earlier this year, was actually covering up the number of people who were dying. So it was a performance of leadership, but it was often the performance of leadership is understood as leadership, right? And then there were a lot of nastier and far uglier ways in which he did this that were also always on display. And in fact, that have also been sort of weirdly appreciated, cringingly appreciated. You know, he's a famous bully. He's had his top staff members be bullies long before this happened. You know, he has some of his top staffers, including his spokesperson, Rich Azzopardi, calling three female members of his own party in the state legislature, I can't use the full phrase, but effing idiots in the newspaper. You know, mm-hmm. He publicly insults people, including in his own party. As many have alleged over years, he worked hard behind the scenes to actually keep his own party out of power in the state legislature by supporting the conservative IDC that kept the legislature out of Democratic hands. But he does it. When I reported a story on him in March, a long reported piece that I did, I talked to so many people who'd worked for him, like on policy, who all described to me a governor who was obsessed with press conferences, right? Obsessed with being out in front of cameras, getting the photo shoot, doing the theatrics of I'm the leader and I'm here in charge, and paid far less attention to the actual mechanics of how to get policies through. He's not a governor who cares very much about policy. And I think even without that reporting, you could see that that's true. But this is not at odds with how we've been taught to understand power in this country, that if you present yourself as dominant and scary, you will dominate and people will be scared of you. And it has worked beautifully for Andrew Cuomo for a very long time. And that's sort of what I mean by the theatrics of dominance.
There is another narrative about him, though, that says the fact that that he had this domineering personality helped him get things done at a policy level, whether it was on time state budgets or tough to pass legislation that they're flailing away at and failing at in Washington, you know, marriage equality before the Supreme Court, gun control after Newtown, like exactly what they wanted at in Washington and have never gotten, banning fracking, $15 minimum wage, that it's his use of power, maybe even compared to his father, that helped get these things done. I can remember somebody was running for president. I wish I could remember who it was in one of the recent primaries. And people said, oh, he's too nice. He's a nice guy, but he won't be an effective executive. So I guess I'm wondering, is there a sweet spot? Is a sweet spot ever possible where somebody really has power, exercises power, but for whom it doesn't fall over into abuse?
Yeah, well, I think that when we accept the framing that whatever Cuomo's achievements as governor are, and we can sort of debate where he came to those issues, because I think a lot of people who've worked on them for decades would say that those a lot of that legislation he actually got to pretty late. And in fact, in some cases, worked perhaps behind the scenes to obstruct until it finally became a reality, and he did it. Those we would have to go issue by issue, but I will say that to absorb that narrative, like he got things done, is to absorb something to accept a framework that we have simply been taught from birth, which is that politics is a hard knuckled game, and you gotta be tough, and keep in mind that all of this is very tied up with ideas about masculinity and particularly white masculinity, right? Mm-hmm. And that all of this happens within, a white patriarchy, a white capitalist patriarchy. But I think Cuomo is a test case for like, wait, can we try to disentangle our ideas about what effective power is, that it doesn't have to be mean, threatening, and scary necessarily. We see somebody who's a bully and very effective at intimidating people and say, wow, well, they really get the job done. And it feeds into ideas that we associate that's what power is to us, is somebody who's tough and mean. And I don't know that that has to be the case.
Come here, Susie. You remember me? Your daddy's friend, Henry?
No, don't!
More than $120 million have been paid out to women who said they were sexually abused by the financier Jeffrey Epstein. Today, Tuesday, marks 2 years since Epstein was found dead in a jail cell in New York while awaiting trial on sex trafficking charges. The compensation was made by the fund set up by his estate. More from our Washington correspondent Gary O'Donoghue.
When they announced this fund a year ago, they were expecting perhaps around 100 people to apply, and more than 250 ended up, or 225 rather, ended up applying. Now, they said that around 150 of those were eligible, and about 135 have been taking a share in this $121 million. Some people have refused the settlement and plan to continue to pursue the matter as a civil matter in the courts, but largely about 90-odd% have accepted the payouts.
Is this the end of the matter, then?
No, there's one final chapter, or, well, I say final, there's one more chapter to go, certainly, and that's the trial of Ghislaine Maxwell, Epstein's former girlfriend. She's accused of helping him to abuse underage girls. She goes on trial in New York at the end of November. She denies the charges.
And briefly, it's a huge amount of money. At some point, there won't be any left in the pot, will there?
Yeah, I mean, the value of Epstein's estate originally was said to be around $600 million. That seems to have plummeted significantly, but there's some obviously other creditors to pay, but there does seem to be still more money left, so that may be being kept back by the executives for these other court settlements that may come further down the line.
Gary O'Donoghue.
I feel like champagne. I understand the idea of celebration. I see the bubbles in champagne as something good and beautiful. Not part of my soul evaporating, but rising with joy. What I'm trying to say is, I don't want champagne. I am champagne. It's great to be alive. Thanks for letting me share.
So, what is it with all this champagne stuff?
Oh, that was, that's just...
It's a metaphor.
Yeah, but I'm not drinking, and that's what's important, right?
Be careful with your metaphors, Doyle.
A leaked and then widely circulated document from the CDC claims that the Delta variant of COVID is as transmissible as the chickenpox. But is that accurate? NPR's Michaeline Duclef looked into it.
One way scientists measure how contagious a disease is by using what's called the R-naught. Karthik Gangavarapu is a computational biologist at the Scripps Research Institute. He says R-naught is the number of people each sick person will infect on average when the entire population is vulnerable to the virus. Nobody has had it. Nobody is vaccinated.
So given ideal conditions for the virus to spread, if it's a completely susceptible population, no one has any immunity, then yes, that would be the expected number of secondary infections caused by one primary infection.
So for example, Ebola has an R-naught of about 2. So
one person ends up infecting 2 other people.
And the flu has an R-naught between 1 and 2. So on average, each person passes it on to 1 or 2 people. What about SARS-CoV-2? When the coronavirus first emerged in 2019, it was slightly more contagious than flu. Then in December, the Delta variant emerged in India. Tom Winsleyers is a biostatistician at the University of Leuven in Belgium. He was one of the first scientists to recognize how dangerous the new variants could be. He says the Delta variant is much more contagious than the original strain of SARS-CoV-2. Its R-naught is more than double.
For the Delta variant, it's now calculated at between 6 and 7. So they are 6.5 is probably about right.
And so what does that mean in practice? First off, it means the Delta variant is not as contagious as the chickenpox, as the CDC's document claimed. Winsleyer says that statement was a bit of an exaggeration.
Yeah, I didn't find it entirely accurate. Chickenpox, the R-naught value, is often put at around 10.
So chickenpox is incredibly contagious. Outbreaks are explosive. There is a big difference between an R-naught value of 10 for the chickenpox and an R-naught value of 6.5 for Delta. So why did the CDC make that claim? A federal official told NPR the claim was, quote, based on preliminary data with a small sample size. More data are coming. But at the end of the day, the message is the same. The Delta variant is much more transmissible than previous versions of the virus, end quote. Winsleyer agrees. He says an R-naught of 6 or 7 is still very, very high, especially for viruses that infect the respiratory tract.
Yeah, intrinsically, of course, it is true that this Delta variant now is, for respiratory viruses, probably the most contagious one that we know about.
Winsleyer says that with an R-naught of 6, Delta will be extremely difficult to stop. To slow it down, communities need to have a very large percentage of the population vaccinated. Those who are not immunized have a very high risk of catching this version of the virus.
Anyone that chooses not to get vaccinated will, in all likelihood, get infected by the virus the coming months.
If you are vaccinated, data continue to show that you are well protected against hospitalization and death, even with the Delta variant. Michaeline Duclef, NPR News.
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore. I want you to get up right now. Get up, go to your windows, open them, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
I'm mad as hell, I'm not going to take it anymore.
I'm mad as hell, I'm not going to take it anymore.
I'm mad as hell.
Among the COVID vaccinated in the U.S., frustration is growing towards those who chose not to get the shot. The argument is that the unvaccinated may be making the pandemic last longer. As Jackie Fortier of member station KPCC in Los Angeles reports, vaccinated people who catch breakthrough COVID-19 infections have a more personal anger.
In early July, Jenny and Mike McHarg stood in line with their two teenage daughters for the Peter Pan ride at Disneyland. It was their first big outing in months. The family was fully vaccinated, and they were excited to spend a few days at the park. But seeing thousands of people without masks was jarring.
Mike even said that first day, the probability of people walking in the park that had COVID and from there that had the actual Delta variant
was high. They were there for 3 days and wore masks in crowded areas. They did take them off when they were eating. The night they drove home, Jenny felt ill.
Then a couple of days later, I really was noticing I couldn't smell and taste.
She opened a jar of garlic to see if she could smell it. She said, I think I can smell this. And it almost knocked me over on the other side of the room. And I said, I'm going to go get us COVID tests right now.
Both Mike and Jenny tested positive for COVID-19.
I did start crying because it was like we did everything right.
Then their younger daughter tested positive.
And now what, we have to be in another kind of forced lockdown, you know, just when we had this little bit of freedom.
Her disappointment is understandable because they took all the precautions recommended at the time. Masks work by reducing the amount of virus a person inhales, says Andrew Neumer, who teaches public health at the University of California, Irvine.
The absolute best practice is to vaccinate and to mask.
Taking your mask off in public to eat or drink cuts down on your protection.
These measures work synergistically. So vaccination and masking is more than just 1 + 1. It's more like 10 times 10.
LA County reinstated an indoor mask mandate in July. Now the focus is on unvaccinated people who make up the vast majority of new cases. That's contributed toward political support for more coercive measures.
We are now half a year into our vaccination campaign. And we need the unvaccinated Angelenos to stop dragging their feet.
LA City Council President Nuri Martinez wants to require vaccination checks before people can enter indoor places such as restaurants and movie theaters.
And quite frankly, I think it's safe to say that we're getting tired of protecting people who don't want to protect themselves or get vaccinated.
In recent weeks, the vaccination rate in California increased by 41%. But that uptick is coming too late for the vaccinated who are already infected.
It's frustrating.
Now more than a month since their trip to Disneyland, Jenny McHarg has regained most of her sense of smell. But Mike has developed cognitive problems caused by COVID-19.
I've just kind of had it. There's no rational and no emotional argument that adds up against getting your damn shot. There just isn't.
Mike is scared his cognitive impairments, like difficulty forming sentences, will prevent him from working as an author and podcaster. And he's angry at people who choose to decline the shot.
Are we a people that come together and make things better? Or are we people who give up when faced with the slightest inconvenience? And I see red because all around me, I start to see more and more signs that maybe Americans are just the give-up crowd.
And he says all people are being asked to do is to take a free, safe vaccine that saves their lives and the lives of others. For NPR News, I'm Jackie Fortier in Los Angeles.
Charges have been issued for two different ethnic intimidation cases in Kent County in one day.
News 8's Heather Walker is talking to one of the victims and is sharing his message tonight. Heather?
Sue and Emily, according to his account of what occurred and the probable cause, he's lucky to be alive. But instead of being angry and hateful, he's thankful and spreading a message of love.
Most ever disturbing thing I've ever seen in my whole life.
That's where it got really scary for us.
That's where he got scared.
Jackie Beard says his family was hanging out at the Staybridge Suites pool off of 29th Street in Kentwood last weekend when a new pool guest joined. Police identified him as Joel Venema.
He slammed his kids in the pool. I was like, okay, they're going to be on the wild side.
Beard says the behavior got worse.
I was like, whoa. I was like, I stepped in there. I was like, could you please take this away from my kids?
That's when Venema allegedly unleashed on Beard.
He's like, F you, N-word, I'm going to kill you, N-word.
Trying to de-escalate the situation, Beard says he started walking away, but Venema wasn't done.
He jumps on the back of my neck.
Court documents say putting him in a chokehold.
It was like, I'm going to kill you, N-word, I'm going to kill you, you're going to die. So I was like, no, I'm not.
Allegedly jumping Beard not once but twice. Beard says he's never had something like this happen before, especially in front of his kids.
I've never heard my baby cry like that. Even she knew in her innocent infant self that something was wrong.
I've had people say the N-word. That's something small to a giant. We shake that off, but physically putting the hands on me, telling me I'm gonna die, and me kind of blacking out.
Beard credits the other pool guests and Kentwood police for being alive today.
I feel like they saved me.
We went to Venema's house to get his side, but no one answered the door, closing the garage door instead. Court documents say after Venema was taken into custody, he continued to use racial slurs, this time on Grand Rapids police officer and another arrestee. Police are also looking into another case at Logan's restaurant in Gaines Township. According to court documents, Donald Fish from Grand Rapids called a black employee at the restaurant a derogatory name and then shoulder checked her. Both incidents happening within the same week.
If he got past me, he could have done anything to any of those people that were sitting out there. And it's not about black and white. It's the same blood. Community. We all bleed the same blood.
And that's his message tonight. Venema is facing 3 charges and more than a decade in prison if found guilty. The man involved in the Logan's incident facing 2 charges and up to 2 years in prison. At the live desk, Heather Walker, News 8.
This question, why is this stuff happening? The New York Times editorial today. The Trump effect. See, this is what I'm doing with my money, buying newspapers like Dick Gregory. The Trump effect and how it spreads. It says we are on the brink, under Trump, on the brink of fascism. New York Times, all the news that's fit to print, editorial 12/10/2015. I say fascism is end-stage white supremacy. See, just like in Nazi Germany. Fascism, system of racism, white supremacy, determined to survive.
A Bay Area man is facing hate crime charges. Pinellas County deputies say 28-year-old Jordan Patrick Leahy intentionally sideswiped a car with a black driver, gave a Nazi salute, and pretended to shoot the driver. Deputies say Leahy then punched the man in the face while screaming a racial slur. He later told police he wanted to shoot 60 to 70 people.
Context of white supremacy. Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, August 14, 2021. So I have been told, man, oh man, it has been daily, everyday terrorism throughout the entire summer months, all of the above. Like, wow, I said it repeatedly. Not sure if Gus T will survive 2021. Man. My battery literally died on me right as we were about to go live for the program. So had to adjust. If anything, I was like, wow, I'm glad I had been proficient with my day and got everything done so that all I needed to do was log on, call in for the program. Everything had already been done. So hopefully, I already requested a battery replacement. I saw that problem was coming. So hopefully I'll be able to replace this within the next day or so, and we will move forward. But wow, it has been just nonstop terrorism. This is our weekly compensatory call-in. Dial in if you have thoughts, observations, counter-racist suggestions to share. The number is 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Share the broadcast if you're on social media, any of the outlets. Share the link. Let people know they can listen live to the call-in. They will have to call in because my computer died. No juice. So they will have to dial in. They can listen, and then we'll have the upload once we are all done. I just want to say really quickly, I have a number of things I'll share, and then we'll get callers as well. I just want to say before I make sure I don't neglect it, that final report was only about 30 seconds in duration where they talked about Mr. Leahy, white male who some sort of rude raid incident, as they call it, sideswiped a vehicle, put up a Nazi salute, said he wanted to shoot, 60, 70 people. It was 30 seconds. If that had been a black male talking about, I want to come out and kill crackers or white people or whatever it is, I want to kill, 50 of five of them, that would have been all over CNN, Fox News, like so many different outlets would have been talking about that and blaming Al Sharpton and President Obama and all that. In this atmosphere, with everything that has happened, they're still trying to get through everything that happened at the Capitol January 6th. White terrorism in this environment, for that to happen, someone is saying, yeah, I want to shoot and kill dozens of people, and you get a 20-second blurb with a Nazi salute, no less, and you get a 20-second blurb, and that's it. Then, and that was the longest news segment that I could find on Mr. Leahy this week. So really, unless you were looking, searching out maybe local news, probably wouldn't hear about that at all. That's not even significant in a system of white supremacy racism. Long live Al Sharpton. Now, so many things this week. My goodness. I have to start with Gus T, self-preservation. Man, I've never had a year where I've had more doubt and felt more in constant danger. I've never in my life tracked how many times have I had to call enforcement officers this week as a measure of my own personal safety, danger, as a metric for how bad my quality of life has been. How many police calls have there been? In fact, the way I've been doing it is blank days since last police call. That's the way that I have been doing it. And I think now there is an asterisk. Currently, it's a little after 7 p.m. Pacific. So if we make it 5 hours, which I don't know, make it 5 hours, that might qualify as 7 days since last police call, which is astounding for but this year. That is amazing. Like, bravo, standing ovation. Like, wow, we've gone a whole week without having to call enforcement officers. Wow. The asterisk is the police were called in my presence today. I witnessed what I thought was an act of white supremacy racism. Random white person on the sidewalk assaulted a black female. Random white man assaulted a black female. She reported it. The police were called. Seemed like totally unprovoked, which there's been a lot of that this year, the last year and a half or what have you. So the police were called in my presence. I did not call. I was just a stunned witness. But the metric for the amount of terrorism that there has been over the past week, year, month, this day is indicative of the entire year within the system of racism, white supremacy. On Sunday, just one day, on Sunday, I awoke a race soldier outside my residence. He's outside at 7 a.m. Cursing, yelling, just being a race soldier, white terrorism. I get up, I call the enforcement officers, which I think I'm trying to, I can't even get in the office. I call the enforcement officers as I'm exiting. So the race soldier, he begins stalking. I think this is one of those where he might have been trying to provoke something, where I've said anybody who's being hostile out in public, you probably do not want to confront them. I'm of the opinion they could be armed, or you have no idea. They could have other individuals there as well who are armed. It's just, it can be a really dangerous situation if this is not something that you have initiated and planned, plotted, and all that. You're just walking into what could be somebody else's trap. Called enforcement officers. I'm exiting. So he's yelling, cursing, stalking me the whole time as I have 911 dispatch on, saying I'm unsafe, I'm being threatened, stalked, boom, 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 give out all the information. She says during the midst of all of this, I'm not, nobody here in this area is a white supremacist. You are just a jerk. Now, Gus T is an annual candidate for Coon of the Year, so, you know. Name calling notwithstanding, like, I made sure to share that on the police report, like, wow. So I went to, I can't even do it correct. So this is just my Sunday for how terrible things. So that started at 7 a.m. I call the enforcement officers. They make a police report, fuss at this white man. They're limited when things like that happen, and they didn't see it. All right. And, of course, got disconnected. Should be back. Sorry about lots of, man, told you it's been just total terrorism. So I left off. I called the enforcement officials. They sent someone over. Since they did not witness this, they generally will say they're limited as to what they can do if there's no evidence of physical violence, which there was none. I didn't see a weapon, but they'll come, they'll make a report and, you know, come do their finger wagging, leave Gus alone, blah, 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 that sort of thing. So after this happens, I call the enforcement officials and I immediately begin filling out the paperwork for a protective order, because now I'm an expert. I've done this before. I have a protective order against my white property owner. I already know the details, get the paperwork. It is a lot of forms to fill out, but, you know, do the documentation, write everything up so I can get that submitted and do that first thing Monday morning to get that taken care of immediately. While I'm doing the paperwork, I remember the report on Richard Sherman where they did the removal of firearms. I fill out the paperwork for that, too. They have that in Washington State. They don't have that everywhere, but I would encourage if they have that in your jurisdiction, use it. So I fill out the paperwork for it's a temporary removal of weapons and permits. I think that's what it's called. So we get that. I fill out all that paperwork on Sunday, which takes a substantial amount of time. Get all of that done. It's been stressful. To put it mildly, I go to one of the parks in Seattle thinking I can relax a little bit. It's a sunny day. Try to calm my jangled nerves. So I'm at Cal Anderson Park, which is in Capitol Hill, Seattle, right in the middle of the city. You can easily walk downtown from Capitol Hill. That was where I lived during my temporary flood residence for like a year and a half, did my yoga studio training and all that. Incidentally, now this is the park itself is really a part of the CHAZ from last summer, Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone. Remember all that? Although they were in the street, but I mean, the park is right there. That's where they had like refreshments and a DJ booth and you could come and kind of kick back for a little bit and lounge in the park and then go back and, you know, roll around in the street and the rest of it. And incidentally, so Cal Anderson Park, boom. I think the adjacent street is Pike. right, to Cal Anderson Park. And then just like a block up from there at 12th and Pike is the police station, which they were, you know, railing against all last summer. So I'm at Cal Anderson Park hanging out. Lovely Sunday afternoon. I'm talking to a Cal's investor. In fact, there's music trickling in the background. And I'm like, where is this coming from? Can you hear this? He says, is that Frankie Beverly and Maze? Yes. They're playing, they start off like with the older music. So like if they're older people, they can come like Luther Vandross and whatever you can think of as like, you know, old timey summer folks type of music. Cool in the Gang, that sort of thing. Then they move to the Drake and all the rest of it, Rihanna, as they get more aggressive, a little bit more rowdier as it gets later in the evening. So they have this chant. This music is not even at the park. This is something that's happening at a condo, like on the opposite side of the park, the opposite side of Pike. But it's so loud, you can just be at the park and be partaking. So this is going on, pleasant little Sunday evening, festivities notwithstanding. At about 10 o'clock, I'm seated at the park, still, you know, trying to decompress. Gunfire rings out. Now, I'm sitting about 100 yards from where I think the shooting erupts. And I'm just sitting there like, is this firecracker foolishness that went on? Is this actual gunfire? And I think part of this was wishful thinking, as they say, like, are you serious? Like, are you serious? Because I'm watching, like, the park is lit up. The park doesn't close, I think, until like 11:30 or sometime well after 10. So I'm seeing people scurrying who are much closer to this than I am. And then I hear someone yelling, like, this is clearly like a shooting has taken place. And so I get up like, yes, okay, shooting at the park. We'll get up. I actually verified this was reported in news outlets. They did make an arrest and get shell casings from the scene. I could not have been a witness to anything because I didn't see anything and was befuddled about what was even happening. But so that was my Sunday beginning to end. Threatened, stalked, 911 call, have to make a police report, fill out paperwork for a protective order, removal of firearms, attempt to go to the park, and a shooting erupts. Second shooting that I have been present for this calendar year, present when it happened live and or was present within 2 minutes. Literally, of the shooting happened and walked right in front of the shooters. Easily the most unsafe year of my time on a very unsafe planet system of white supremacy. Like, wow. Total disgrace. And frankly, I think they reported they've had a number of shootings at Cal Anderson Park. We'll avoid Cal Anderson for the foreseeable future, even though I think that's easily the park that I've visited most in my time in Seattle. It's right in the middle of the city, and it's right next to the light rail and lots of other things. It's right on Broadway for people who know Sir Mix-a-Lot, My Posse on Broadway. Remember that one? Oh, speaking of oldie but goodies, they might have played that one at the party on Sunday. Broadway is also adjacent to Cal Anderson Park, so Pike is adjacent. On the we don't need enough geography about Seattle. Shooting at Cal Anderson Park, Gus was there. Wow, most dangerous year ever. Death at every corner. Let's see, to some of the actual news report, they have the earthquake in Haiti. Speaking of death, we can get a news report about that. That's so current. They reported at least 200 deaths. Man, what a year. Right after the assassination, and they hadn't even made sense of that. And I think I just said, like, the U.S. military could come in and take over. I just said that, like, oof. With all of this, like, for reals, it might be, yeah, we might have to have the U.S. military come in and at least get things stabilized for a while. We don't want things, what they'll say, we don't want it to go off the rails. But that for sure happened in Haiti. Let's see, I'm trying to get, I'll share a few on some of the audio reports that we heard, and then we'll get to the folks who dialed in. Let's see, so some of the things that we heard in the audio report, man, the census, we began and ended with Dr. Francis Gress Welsing. I'm so happy that within shootings and tech problems and everything else, just general terrorism, I am so glad I was able to get Dr. Welsing, White Genetic Annihilation, reminding us that white people are less than 10% of the global population, and the census data that came out this week talking about the declining population of whites in the U.S. So important. There were so many reports talking about anger, rage, about lots of different things like white genetic annihilation. The grandsister, Dr. Frances Cress Welsing, she talked about that on a regular basis. That was, I mean, the foundation of her theory in terms of why she thought, what her conclusion was about what was motivating white people to practice racism, white supremacy. The disconnected me right when I was talking about Dr. Frances Cress Welsing's white genetic annihilation. That's two disconnects. I just said tech difficulties. In spite of all of that, Dr. Welsing was grounded. Her theory was grounded in individuals classified as white, less than 10% of the global population. That census report, I suspect, and I mean, it was everywhere, PBS, NPR, all the major outlets, LA Times, New York Times, Washington Post, everybody, BBC, no way that you could miss that. The white brain computer, those road rage incidents, Mr. Leahy said he wanted to kill 60, not one, not three, not five, not 12, 60 or 70. I submit that as response of white genetic annihilation. Dylan Stormroof, remember? All right, so the reports, they talked about the in vitro fertilization in Chicago, how expensive it is, that no coincidence that was in sequence with the census report, white genetic annihilation. They said that's $12,000 per treatment, and you might need multiple sessions for it to actually work for the couple to actually be able to conceive. I do not see in this environment, yes, we need more Michael Brown Juniors. Yes, let's make sure that we get, you know, in vitro fertilization for all of the black people. No way. Let's see. Wow, that's three disconnects. Three disconnects, like, wow, constant. And I'm sitting in the same spot that I've been doing most of the recent programs. I haven't had this many disconnections just rapidly every 5 minutes. Usual suspects. At any rate, Tish James, we talk about that in Neutralizing Workplace Racism all the time, where they will slip in, white people will begin these references and calling another black person by some nickname or what have you. I've never heard in a professional capacity anyone come out and, oh, yes, Tish James. It's Letitia James. Attorney General James, in fact, that's what it would be. Maybe, and again, maybe they're homies. I still submit that that's incorrect, an act of racism. And I would just say, listen out. When you hear other elected officials, we're not talking about the dog catcher or the librarian. When you hear other powerful elected officials, when you hear them referenced, do they call them by their name or do they make up these little slick nicknames and what have you? Continuing down my list, hoping that I don't get disconnected again. Let's see. Oh, my goodness. The incident with the pool. So that was closer to the end. Make sure I get the victim's name correct. Jackie Beard. Jackie Beard. So this is the segment where they were at the pool and they were terrorized. It's been lots of random, unprovoked white terrorism. So they're at the pool. He says this fella comes in, a random white man, I guess, and he starts by slamming his own children in the pool. I thought that's what he said. And then he comes and says, I'm going to kill you, and grabs him and is choking him and all the rest. That's been the whole year, 2021. Mr. Jackie Beard, that is a cowbell. Now, I didn't insert it in the clip, but, I mean, there is video to that. So he was standing with a white woman. Looks like that would be his so-called family. That may have been a part of what motivated this attack on – not that, you know, that makes it correct. Like, victim, I mean, he's a victim. That just means – Mr. Fuller said double whammy. But that is a cowbell, and that may have been a part of what instigated this attack at the pool. where they got this fellow arrested. Let's see. Oh, let me go back. Rebecca Traister, and when she was talking about Governor Cuomo, there were several points I wanted to make sure I got in. One, she did a lot of assuming and talking about how collective we see a white man in power who's a bully and who can just harass other people and say, oh, man, that's just politics. And wow, he gets things done. He's tough. And wow, you know, that's just what politicians do. I do not think, or let me start, Gus T, that is not my view. I do not enjoy someone bullying and harassing. I don't view that as, wow, he knows how to get things done. You're just a bully and probably a racist. That's what I think. That doesn't impress me. You can be professional and get things done without name calling and harassing people. I've seen that. A lot of that is just racism, white supremacy, plantation mentality. And then she makes a collective assumption like we all think that way. I think many of us have been really forced, brain trashed to accept that as, hey, that's how white men function. That is white culture. In fact, that's how a lot of white men and white women function, enjoy function, as Mr. Fuller says, the royalists, riding around splashing mud on people and embarrassing them because I'm a powerful white woman or I'm a powerful white man. Then when she does get to the point where she says, when we're talking about masculinity and that's white masculinity and white capitalist patriarchy, not white supremacy racism, white capitalist patriarchy, which again excludes white women. We're not culpable. She's a white woman, Rebecca Traister. We're not culpable. This is white male patriarchy, white capitalist patriarchy, whatever that is. Again, they get away from racism, white supremacy, in her book about white women's anger. Whatever. Let's see. The segment where they talk about the non-white female in Seattle being attacked by a white man who was a former New York EMT. I thought those are folks who are supposed to be about healing, right? Isn't that the ambulance if there's an emergency and they got the siren and get there as quick as possible to heal, to help? What are you doing out terrorizing? And that was a cowbell too, I think. Didn't they say that this former EMT, he avoided her white partner and struck her, assaulted her, and was going to leave if her white partner hadn't said something? Tried Dylan Root, and he was talking about that too. Let's see. I just own that. Last thing I'll say, the segment, I think our caller in Florida, Governor DeSantis, was talking about the term unvaccinated and just paying attention to how that's used. And I said categorically, in my view, unvaccinated means non-white. They had the report last week, just categorically, the vast majority of non-white people on the planet have not been vaccinated. And then even when you break it down into individual so-called countries in the white-dominated areas where there are non-white people, it's mostly white people who've got the vaccine. That's over and over. And they can bring out all the fake news, racist reports they want, talking about Tuskegee and distrustful black people. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Racism, white supremacy is why this is global. I haven't heard anybody say, man, the Nigerians are talking about Tuskegee. And they don't want to. I haven't heard that from anybody. Anyway, when they got to that report about people being angry with the unvaccinated, I said, wait a minute, you got a family that went to, what did they say, Disneyland, and they see people not wearing masks. I don't think this is exactly the time I'd be going to Disneyland. California's had lots of problems with the virus, COVID-19, going all the way back to last year, a so-called hotspot. They were regressing going back to masks anyway. You already know we got bogus vaccine cards. You already know a lot of people, white people, have been defiant about all of this for almost 2 years. Why am I, and particularly, why am I going to risk taking my children out to an environment with a large number of people with the hope that they will be safe when nothing about the last year has been safe? It's been reckless and defiant every day. That's one. And then I'm mad at the unvaccinated. They've had tons of reports about people who are vaccinated and they still got the virus. They just said the vaccine is supposed to keep you from dying and having all of the really intense symptoms. Unless I'm misinformed, I'm not a medical expert. But continuing anything, I'm very suspicious when they start talking about we're angry, we're upset with these people. Like, oh, man, like that. Be suspicious, be concerned when there starts to be white rage directed at specific groups. Invariably, it becomes black people. That can be excuse, justification for all manner of violence. I'll stop there. As usual, for the compensatory call-in, I request that we not do metaphors. You heard the report where they compared COVID-19 to chickenpox. Now, that's a simile because they said as. It's as contagious as, like as simile. But that same thing, analogies, metaphors. That's four times being disconnected. Usual suspects, like what the world, every 5 minutes, literally. Anyway, as I say, for the usual broadcast metaphors, you heard the segment where they compared COVID-19 to being as contagious as chickenpox. And they said that that is not accurate. Investigate those similes, comparisons. That's why I say just let's try to be precise, accurate with what we say. Race soldiers, they can consistently use those metaphors and comparisons to be deceptive, primarily with racism, white supremacy. Victims, non-white people, myself included, we are still learning. Sometimes we just don't have all of the information, logic to articulate our views. And so we'll substitute some sort of comparison, analogy, metaphor. If we could work to be precise, exact with our verbiage, that would be super appreciated. If you could take about 5 minutes to share your thoughts, observations, views, that would be great, just to make sure that everybody has at least one opportunity to speak. If you need additional time, just allow everyone to get their one chance to speak, and then you can come back with more questions, thoughts, observations. The number again is 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Again, this broadcast not for spectators. So many things happening in the world. There should be no way we should have folks just spectating. I'll get in my last thing, man, about sand. So it's not all doom and gloom. I did get to go to Golden Gardens Beach twice this week, consecutive days, in fact. Golden Gardens is one of the best beaches in Seattle. It is, wow, absolutely amazing. That would be high on the list of must-dos if you visit Seattle. But I was at Golden Gardens, and there was a group of people walking by, and they said that the sand in Hawaii is more coarse than the sand here in Seattle. Now, that caught my attention because I have been to Hawaii. Hung out on the beaches in Hawaii for months. I got to go to many, many of the beaches. So I was trying in my mind, I'm going back so I can compare the sand in Hawaii and the sand here. And I thought of Mr. Fuller, who goes to the bottom of the ocean. He said, and we'll study one grain of sand. It hadn't even come to my mind to like think and compare because I've been to so many different beaches. I've been to the beach in Jamaica and the beach in California and the beach in Virginia and lots of it, obviously now here in Seattle, lots of different places to compare, like, what's the difference in the sand in these environments and all of that? Be scientific, be curious about everything. Golden Gardens is amazing. Oh, I could give you a quick twofer. Man, Maurice White, I mentioned Earth, Wind, and Fire. They probably played him at the party too. Keep your head to the sky. I was at Golden Gardens, and before I was having major tech problems, I had my computer, and I wanted to watch the documentary, Untold, The Malice at the Palace. I'm watching it, and I hear this time a different group of white people, and they say, wow, look at the sky. It's amazing. It looks like a picture. So I stopped, and I look up. It was amazing. I took a picture. Seeing the sunset at Gold, that's why it's called Golden Gardens. Seeing the sunset out there is majestic, worthy of art. And then, twofer, they have the meteor shower this week. being at the beach because it's not all that artificial light everywhere, so it's dark, so you can get a nice, clear view of the night sky. Keep your head to the sky. I hope folks were able to take some time and look up and catch some of the meteor shower and all the celestial events. There are forces greater than racism, white supremacy. Let's snap some of the callers before I get disconnected again. Let's see. Star 61, if you have commentary, the number again, 720-716-7300, the code 564-943 pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. All right, switchboard. All righty, first few folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Feel free to proceed.
Can I be heard?
Heard both of you. We'll take non-question Brad first.
Oh, okay, that works. Hello, all. Just got a couple of things listening to some of the broadcast. Obviously, the U.S. Data has been released, and it said that the non-white population has declined to less than 60%. During the mornings when I drive to work, I listen to usually White Wing Radio because I find it just interesting. And they're constantly talking about things like capitalism, Marxism, and socialism. And I noticed the language changing over the last couple of weeks. So, for example, they're saying things like the country is becoming less capitalist and more communist, Marxist, or socialist. And I think there's a correlation there between, you know, the white population, you know, decline in percentage, not amount, but percentage, and that kind of language. The urban heat island effect, obviously, you know, where black people live, the redlined areas, you know, less trees, hotter areas, more potential for heat stroke and stuff like that. This is also correlated with traffic incidents as well, too. Less, you know, the places where you find less trees and stuff is where you're going to find also more car accidents. When you see a whole bunch of trees and you're driving, it tends to make you slow down. But when the area is kind of opening and, you know, your windshield is clear, it makes you speed up and, of course, more accidents. But, of course, you know, more people walking around in a very hot area potentially hurting their health. And then the family, the people who said, you know, they're really mad at people who are getting unvaccinated. To me, I'm a little confused by that. You know, even if other people are getting unvaccinated, they're vaccinated. So even if they catch COVID, you know, unfortunately that they catch COVID and potentially get sick, why does you know, they have no idea that they caught COVID from a vaccinated or unvaccinated person. So who are they to decide that the unvaccinated person is the problem or the reason why they got sick, even if they did or did not get vaccinated? With that, I'll mute my line.
Excellent point, non-Clemson grad. The precise attribution, it was you unvaccinated who are responsible for this when they said, oh, yeah, you can be vaccinated and still transmit, still obviously catch the vaccine or catch the virus, COVID-19 as well. Let's see, much obliged, non-Clemson grad, retired firefighter in Ron DeSantis land. Did you have commentary, sir? You should be with us.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings to everyone. We are starting another session of the DCS mentoring program. Today was basically the entry with the parents to the program. The first thing that took place was Mr. Clark addressed the parents as far as some responsibilities that they should be partaking in to make the entire venture successful by the assignments that are given out, that they make sure they go over it with their children. From there, to be timely on dropping off as well as picking up their children. This is not a babysitting service. It's a project that's designed to assist primarily, unfortunately, black females who whereas a adult age male is not in the same house where the male children are located at, is to assist them. So, you know, try to be consistent on dropping off the child in a timely manner and picking the child up at the end of the session. The sessions are from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. So it gives that parent plenty of time that they can do other things. We basically have their male child for basically the whole day on Saturdays. And in turn, he introduces all of the mentors, and they have time to have a little bit to say to the parents as far as about themselves, and that's how it went. I didn't hear a lot on the earthquake in Haiti on the news, especially it was much more publicity on it when it took place, what was that, about 5 to 10 years ago. Didn't hear a whole lot about it. Probably it may have been because I hadn't been near a television or anything like that. But I wonder if anybody else has the same observation, because I'm not sure of that. I just know I haven't heard a whole lot about it. Somebody sent me a report on it. But anyway, that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter in Florida. I'm not, that's the 2010 earthquake in terms of comparison. It seemed like that got a lot of media attention, like Spike Lee included a segment on that in one of his documentary films, and lots of well-known people were talking about it. There was lots of news coverage and video coverage. I think even back of the bus, co-founder at the Cows here, he talked about, in his view, some of the necrophilia around that, because there was so much death, and that might be a part of it. Now, this is a very current event. The most recent reports, and it's not like I got time to read exhaustively on this, but just one of the most recent reports that I saw, they reported that there were at least 200 deaths and probably a lot more, but at least right now it was at least 200 deaths that I guess they had confirmed at this point. And it seemed like the earthquake from 2010 may have been substantially more devastating in terms of the loss of life from the initial reports and all of that. Obviously we'll find out more in the coming days and all, but that might be part of it. Obviously the COVID-19, lots of other things happening on the planet as opposed to what was going on way back in 2010. Yeah, that'll be something to think about in terms of how much coverage is it going to be. Some and the just with the assassination of the president too. That's kind of, I guess, or that is majorly impacting how all of this will be viewed in terms of, wow, this is happening with such a vacuum of leadership and trying to figure out how they're going to move forward and such. So, yeah, that'll be interesting to kind of pay attention and just to see if other people, have they been paying attention to it? Have they, you know, focused on other things? Like I said, it's so many things happening in the world. Might just be, yeah, bad things are always happening down in Haiti. We'll have to get to that later.
Yeah. Racism, from what I read, it was more powerful. This recent one was more powerful than the one years ago. Like you said, I guess it'll be some more information comes out on it. I was out all day, so I didn't get a chance to look at anything on the news, but I'll pick it up maybe sometime tonight after the program.
Hello, may I be heard?
I can hear you. I think Gus may have gotten cut off again.
Oh, I got confused with my mute button. I just said that's Irie in Louisiana, and I just mentioned that Spike Lee did include a segment on the 2010 Haitian earthquake in his documentary on the recovery from Hurricane Katrina and the levee failure in one of his documentary films. But Irie in Louisiana, yes, ma'am.
Yes, thank you. It's really short. I read a part of a Bloomberg article that was released today about the disaster in Haiti, and I found this one passage interesting that I want to share. It said, U.S. President Joe Biden authorized an immediate response and designated the U.S. Agency for International Development to coordinate the effort, according to White House officials. And I just thought it was interesting. One, I've never heard of a U.S. Agency for International Development, but then I was also thinking, International Development, not, you know, any type of disaster recovery agency. And it made me think of how after the earthquake, the previous earthquake, the Clinton Foundation, or the Clintons, through the guise of the Clinton Foundation, went down and did recovery efforts, or I guess we could call it development as well, and ended up being in control of a large gold mine in Haiti and still maintain control of it. And that's all I wanted to share. Thank you.
Much obliged, Irie in Louisiana. We talked quite a bit about, we were on Broadcast the Cows 2009. We were broadcasting during the earthquake, and I remember one of the programs, Lisa Marie Rollins, that we did, and I believe that was right at the end of Black History Month, or right at the early part of March, Women's History Month, I guess, for 2010. Lisa Marie Rollins, non-white female, who was adopted by white parents, I believe, right here in Seattle, unless my memory is failing me. But we talked about, because she talks about so-called transracial adoption. We had that segment that was played this week of talking about that. Black female in Rob, formerly in Wisconsin, saying she was adopted by her white family out there, talking about that experience. But Lisa Marie Rollins and some of our other guests even talked about how it was a group of white people. I have to see if I can find the report, even though I'm hobbled tech-wise. But there was a group of white people who went down to Haiti and took advantage to go and steal black children. And I think it wasn't just one. It was like 20, like dozens of young Haitian children, and were trying to steal them and smuggle back. Not, you know, oh, man, we're concerned and this is a horrible tragedy. What can we do to keep the family intact? Like, that's supposed to be the goal of child care and reunion, keep you all together, and not to come in and be buzzards. And I'm using that metaphor deliberately. And oh, we can steal some black babies here and come back and rape them and all the rest of it. Jerry Sandusky and Jeffrey Epstein and all the rest of that. This was like widely reported. We talked about that. Lisa Marie Rollins, we talked about this 2010, right in the early portion of the program. Like, lots of, you know, payback and just anytime you have black people who are super vulnerable. Oh, yes, the predators. Jeffrey Dahmer, Woody Allen, Mia Farrow. That's what we're talking about in the book club right now. Ooh, Vietnam, vulnerable non-white people. Oh, let's go steal some children. Like, find me a wife. Find some 6 months old. Like, yes, yes. Context of white supremacy. Number again is 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Again, the broadcast
not for spectators. If folks have any thoughts on the census report, thought that was important, white genetic annihilation. Let's see. We'll check, see if other folks still spectating what they have thoughts. See, folks, looks like they are spectating, not going to, because I had to work way too hard to get things done, even to be broadcasting today. So we're not doing the hangout just to spectate. And there were way too many things happening, like folks should have views and thoughts on the Senate. I mean, that is racial classification confusion. Exactly as it has been outlined, they're talking about with the census and saying they had this huge increase in people who identify as more than one race. Now, that's absurd on so many different levels, lacking logic. How are you a member of multiple races, so-called, when there is only one race, not the human race? Confusion. I would expect lots more confusion with this announcement, declining white population, like system of racism, white supremacy. The white brain computer responds to that. Those reports about the poor. And even I forgot to talk about confusion. I mentioned Mr. Beard. Johnny Beard, I believe his name was, the victim at the pool incident. He got choked, strangled, and I said that's a cowbell. It looked like he was in a tragic arrangement of some sort. That is important, in my view, the confusion, tragic arrangement, because he was the one who said later on in that interview that he said this random race soldier came up and tried to choke him, to kill him. That's what the guy said, I'm going to kill you, and proceeded to try to choke him out. And the victim, Mr. Beard, he said he felt like he was blacking out. He was losing consciousness. He said, the victim, it's not about color. Wait a minute. You said this guy is calling you nigger and not just calling you racist names, but from the report, they said he was detained, he's arrested, and then once he's at headquarters, he continues. Apparently, he's calling other people at the police department, nigger this and nigger that and all the rest of it, after he's tried to kill a black person. What do you mean? It's not about color. And when I'm submitting, hey, I think this might have happened because of tragic arraignment. We might have had two of those this week where a non-white person was attacked, one female, one male, because they were in a tragic arrangement. You can factor that as well with white genetic annihilation. That's also contributing to declining population of whites. Let's see. Folks have thoughts. Other people who dialed in with a hand up. Let's see.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings, callers and listeners. What's going on in Haiti is consistently tragic, terroristic, and very, very suspicious. And a lot of the news articles of like the attacks just is really, really, really disturbing. And you often mention Jerry Sandusky. I just learned about this guy's white supremacist named Larry Nassar, who like sexually assaulted like hundreds of females. Even Simone Biles was sexually molested and raped by him. And this guy should be known worldwide by victims of racism, but they do such a really good job at hiding this information. Like you mentioned that clip where they'll talk about a white person murdering people for 30 seconds, but a black male, they'll spend a lot of time and energy on that. And this complex cell I live in, we recently discovered that My downstairs neighbors has a Nazi swastika on his chest, but I long suspected him of being a white supremacist. So that's that. And something really tacky and trashy and terroristic happened to me last week when I was doing some constructive swimming. This white child stalked me because when I was walking to the pool, I saw him with a toy gun, and I knew he was going to follow me, and I knew exactly what he was going to do the moment I saw him, but he followed me to the pool. He kept pointing his toy gun at me and pulling the trigger to the point where I was like, I have to record this. I went back to my cell and recorded it, and then I asked him a question. I was like, do you like shooting black people? And then he nodded his head, no, and then he stopped doing it for a bit. And then he continued doing it, and I just was laughing it off at that point. I may have made an error, because after he nodded his head no, I told him, then stop, instead of asking him, then why are you doing it? But, you know, that's my error. But system white supremacy, really, really tacky, terroristic, and I'll mute my line. Thanks for letting me share.
In this environment, like, come on, like they will bring up Newtown. That was mentioned in the sound clip. They'll bring up Newtown, gun violence, and youth suicide, and youth gun violence. Won't they bring up Columbine? Excuse me. It will. They'll bring up Aurora, Colorado. They have shootings there all the time. Remember the Batman shooting? I think that was 2012. Memory might be off. On that one, but around that time period, but they have shootings out there in Colorado on a regular basis. But come on, that's what we want to promote. And then he's shooting at a black person. I love the question. Do you like shooting black people? And he shakes his head no. Yeah, I mean, that one, hey, you can, I like either the follow-up question. So why are you doing that? Just even see what he says, you know. But racist man, racist woman, racist child, even, you know, observing, are you going around, are there other people at the pool? You're not going around to do that to any other people? Interesting. The brain computer has already processed whom to target. The black male. Let's see, other folks who dialed in, much obliged, sir. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary to share, proceed.
Gus T. Renegade.
Yes, sir. Did you have commentary?
Hello, Gus. It's nice to speak to you once again. Guys, first of all, I need to give thanks to the Creator that you're still alive after your incident in the park, having to report the man with the firearm, I do believe. And I have a story to tell you, guys, and I'm a little bit spiritual, and it's just amazing how what you said and the reason why I phoned in to tell you how they coincide. Am I being heard, Gus?
Yes, sir. Proceed.
Excellent. Mr. Renegade, I phoned a couple of weeks ago, and I told you a story about Priti Patel, how she didn't give the police force a raise, and they was kind of upset with her. I forgot the reason exactly why I told you that story. But today, or a few days ago, we had an incident, and I'm going to tell you the incident. A young man was playing around with a gun, maybe making threats to people, and he was reported to, as you call them, law enforcers. And the law enforcers investigated this man, and they took his gun away from him in September, Gus. Now, it's August now, and I think last month they gave him the gun back, Gus. And then a few weeks later, he went and shot to dead his mother, a 3-year-old young child, and the child's father. And then he went to a park like where you were, Gus, and he shot dead another 2 people in the park. Now, just like you did, Gus, somebody reported him that he was acting dangerous or crazy or threatening with a firearm. And the police force, they investigated incidents. They agreed that his gun should be taken away from him, which he did, or which they did. And then maybe 6 months later, he's cooled down and he's come to his senses. They gave him the gun back, Gus. Now, I mentioned Priti Patel, that the police are not happy with him. She comes into the picture and she wants to know now, why on earth did the police give this man his gun back 2 weeks ago, after he's been reported to not be worthy of having a gun? Now, Gus, there's a bit more to this. I hope I've got time just to tell you a little bit extra, goes from my mind. This man, the gun that they took away from him was not a revolver or a rifle or even a shotgun, Gus. This gun was a pump action shotgun that they gave back to him. The one that he got a rack. One of those ones, Gus. And another thing, Gus, that I think is extremely important to know about this story. Now, this wasn't a 50-year-old man, Gus, you know, respectable, had years of, life and experience behind him, or even a guy of, let's say, 30, who specializes in firearms. Don't forget, this young man, he had a license given to him by the police. This man was only 22 years old, Gus, and he shot his mum, a young 3-year-old, after being reported for acting violent with a gun, and also being given the gun back. Gus, there's some other aspects to this story that you might be interested in, if you want to know, but I'm going to stop there and hear what you have to say about that.
That's almost Free White and 21 with having these really young race soldiers who, you know, have their firearms and are ready to go out and kill. I say that all the time, like people in public, like you should think about that before going to approach someone who's being hostile. They could be armed and ready to kill. They might have a whole entourage. You never know. I can only say with those firearms, I literally, that's the first time in my life last Sunday that I ever filled out that paperwork. I talked about that with Richard Sherman, how they removed his guns, and they said thankfully because he was suicidal and then under influence, and so I guess he did not get his guns back. So a terrible situation could have been way worse, even though that isn't the word God did not say. But I would strongly encourage, if it's someone classified as white, because often they'll have so many guns, and so as he said, not like a revolver or a little 6-year or something, assault rifles and semi-automatic and modified and all this other stuff. So you, if they have those laws where you can, if someone is being unsafe and threatening and hostile, report, document, and see if you can get their weapons and permits removed. If they have a concealed carry, they'll take that as well, because you just never know, particularly now with people being under so much stress and upset about so many things and rage about so many things, the unvaccinated and all the rest of it. Oh, yeah. If you have any sort of temper problem, anger issues, you don't need a firearm. Lots of things for you to be reckless with already. You don't need a weapon. So, yeah, that is horrendous for this person to have their firearms back and then to get this pump action shotgun back to go out and do all this car and at a park, no less. I'm not surprised. It's been a whole,
year and a half, especially here in the U.S., like shootings and shootings and shootings at parks and workplaces and anywhere else. Let's see. You had 60 seconds left, so I don't know if you wanted to get into your last 60 seconds to shoot. I mean, you know, just for your five.
Yeah, I do appreciate that. Briefly, the angle that the media is coming at it from is not a terrorism. They've been struggling, whether it's terrorism or not. They're coming at the angle on being a man that hates women because he shot his mother and a young girl and the father of the baby and another woman and somebody else. It might be another woman. And they're dead. Yeah, that's the angle that they're coming at. It's not a racist thing because the people he shot were his own kind. I do believe. So that's where I'm going to leave it. Yeah. That's the angle. That he's a woman hater. And why are men doing this? That's what the media is saying. Thank you for listening. And I hope I was able to be understood.
Unknown from unknown galaxy. Much obliged, sir. Yeah, I understood it. Understood it. And that sounds like the same narrative with Elliot Rodger and other times where it'll be a white person. And that's the same thing where they won't just say, hey, these are white men who are committing these crimes. What is wrong with them? Where they are identified and identified racially for these violent crimes. Then, as he said, terror. Why isn't this terror? You went to a park? Why isn't that an act of terrorism? Children are at the park. They got swing sets and, you know, people are out just trying to get some vitamin D. Why isn't that an act of terrorism? Gunfire has burst out at the park. What happened when I was at the park? People are fleeing. They were out playing Frisbee 1 minute and got the dog with them. And now I got to run for my life. Why isn't that terrorism? Because the person committing the crime, perpetrator, as they say, is white. That's my answer to it. If someone has a better answer, then less if they call them rude.
I totally agree. Mm-hmm. I can only say to myself, as if it was a black guy that they took the gun from, would they give it back to him?
Somebody would have been fired. Like if that had been, you know, some black person where they had done all that, taking their firearms, and this person had been reported for, wow, I don't know, this guy's kind of unsafe and threatening. And I don't think he's a fighter. And then you give it back to him and they go and do what? Go to a park, no less? Come on. Somebody is losing their job. Like, you got to be kidding.
Well, that's what Priti Patel is looking into, Gus. That's why I mentioned her name again. So I'm waiting to see what she's going to do about it. Because as a black woman, I want to see her fire somebody high in the police force. As you said, somebody should lose their job, but let's see if that does happen.
White people don't get fired. They get transferred. We'll see what happens with this incident, especially if it's a non-white person who's supposed to be investigating to see if that's going to happen. Like, we shall see. I'm sorry, did I hear? Did I miss something?
I just said she's their boss. I was agreeing with you, you know. She's not just the person, she's their boss.
I see, yeah. Well, we will see how that goes with a non-white person who is the boss in charge. We talked about that on Workplace Racism yesterday. We'll see how all of that unfolds with the investigation. Let's see. Are there any folks we missed totally? Make sure we don't miss anybody that hasn't shared at all. May I be heard? Caller in Florida? Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners and callers. I wanted to mention the, I think the segment was in the Tennessee area. They may have been talking about maybe the, I didn't hear them say the critical race theory, but how they, I guess, got a somewhat of a fierce response, I'm suspecting, from white parents, I'm thinking, about talking about the issue of race. So they said the term white privilege and sex and race or something like that. And, I can see white people definitely getting upset about that. And young white children learning about that in the classrooms. And there was another report I saw about a thing. It was, and also in the Tennessee area, the Tennessee School Board. And I'm glad you mentioned the unvaccinated term, because I didn't hear that word get used in this context, where you had, now we already have this variant that's way more severe than the previous variant. The Delta variant is hospitalizing people all over the so-called United States, for example, and you have these people where I think they're classified as white, for the most part, no mask, and they're very angry, and they are sounding confident about, we're not going to do this, and I'm not having my child come to school with a mask. And in the report, it said that they threatened the nurses and the doctors and saying, we're coming for you. Then the guy at the podium, he was like, oh, but not in a non-violent way or whatever he said. He tried to switch it up. But the barbaric approach they had in their language. And I saw also a bunch of clapping and support, just like in that segment, the audio with the white guy talking about go back to Vietnam. It was the same style, white supremacists uniting, it looks like. And it was even, I saw a segment where white people were were being hostile with other particular white people. And I never heard them use the term unvaccinated. Instead, they used the words anti-maskers and anti-vaxxers. Now, I think that word was being used a few weeks ago, but it does look like they are associating unvaccinated with non-white people, black people. And for anti-vaxxers, whenever they pull up an image of a white person, they'll use that term, a video footage with white people protesting, no mask, et cetera. In the segment where I think the Asian, the non-white female, I think Japanese, where she said she couldn't breathe because she had blood in her mask. I think that may have been a tragic arrangement. They said in the audio that it was a white man that may have tried to have a tussle or confrontation with the other person. I guess that might have been a white person that attacked her. And she was at the end saying that what could really get you into a mold or something where you'll start thinking, well, they don't want me here. They want me to go back. Something like that. Exactly. So that can have an effect. As I heard Mr. Fuller mention, as well as you, Gus, about the Area 8 and how that can have an effect on your mind. I wanted to mention that. And the last thing I wanted to mention is, It was school started just this week, as I mentioned before, earlier or yesterday, and there was a white child. Now, I wanted to look up this report locally in the High Springs area in my county, where she was like, no, I'm not going to wear a mask. So they had to send the child home, right? So the dad came to pick up the white child, and he's arguing with the assistant principal and saying, well, you're denying my child an education, but we have a mask mandate in order for the county. And it's even going to the point to where, like the news has mentioned, I believe they are suing the governor, I believe. So this even, they've instilled it into the children now, white children. Basically, it's like they're saying I'm white, basically, but they're not. But I know that I'm a white child. I'm a young white girl, and you're not going to tell me what to do. You can send me home or whatever. But she just basically denied that she was going to put on a mask. So they called the parent to come get her. I'm not sure what happened after that, but there was a younger brother she had, and he was asked to put on a mask, and he put his on. But when they were interviewing the whole white family, they said that, oh, well, they did it without their parents' consent. And the white father was angry about that. So it's, once again, like you mentioned, the defiance. So they didn't want to wear the mask. And they even came to the city, the ABC World News, to the hospital. So it's definitely starting to spread more. And that's all I wanted to share. Thanks for allowing me to speak.
Now, that context of white supremacy, much obliged to our caller in Florida. Now, that right there, that is that word that they use so much when we had President Trump emboldened. Now, when your governor, Mr. DeSantis, comes on wearing a mask, get out of here. In fact, I don't want to hear nothing about the Rona until you do something about the border, Mr. President. Talk to me about some mask and Rona. You get on out of our Florida business. Now, when the governor is behaving in that manner, and then all of the white people who voted for Mr. DeSantis, isn't it laughable that they were talking about Andrew Gillum was going to be governor? All of the white people, DeSantis, that's our dude. I'm not wearing a mask. I'm not doing any of this. White defiance, as I said the whole time. That's why I said all of that is fake news. All the reports, Tuskegee and black people are suspicious. Fake news. Racism, white supremacy. These white people have done this for 2 years basically now. And so their children, obviously, I'm not wearing a mask. You're not the boss of me. Well, you're in school. You're not the boss of me. You don't tell me what to do. You don't run kindergarten. You don't run fifth grade. I'm grown. I'm not going to wear a mask either. Like, do what? And he said that. Those little white children, they're bringing computers on. Now, I'm sure if I'm in Washington State, I'm 3,000 miles away from Florida. I've heard, hasn't the governor, he's come out the whole time, said, we're not wearing masks in school. This is preposterous. You're not going to mandate that our little children wear masks in school. We're not doing it. Get out of here. You've heard that, and your parents are with that, and, you know, we're not doing all the rest of it, vaccinations and anti-vax and all the rest of it. Psh, I'm not doing any of this. I heard our governor. If you can't include that in your report, or you, in fact, give me a whole separate report on why white people have been behaving like this for so long and so many of them. No more fake news about skeptical black people at Tuskegee. That's important, too, with the just noting the difference. The unvaccinated, I think they're talking about non-white people when they say that. The anti-vaxxers. And the anti-masks, that's like a totally different crowd. Although those folks, if just following logic, if you're not going to wear a mask, I can't imagine you submitting to a vaccine. So the anti-vaxxers and the anti-maskers would have to be unvaccinated, just following logic. That is an important distinction because I've seen those saying. It seems like every time, because I mean, it's no shortage. You got tons, throngs of them, thousands of them. Sometimes the white anti-vaxxers and the white anti-maskers, just call them unvaccinated. And these are the people that you're mad at, your neighbors and cousins and family members and the rest of them who listen to Fox News and Governor DeSantis. Let's see. Number again, 720-716-7300, the code 564 #943#. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Just wanted to make sure I got in before I forgot. The victim, his name is Jackie Beard, the black male who was attacked at the pool, who also, tragic arrangement, I said it might have been two different reports where a non-white person got attacked for being in some sort of tragic arrangement. And it's the same thing where downplaying the racism, white supremacy. I think our caller in Florida, where he was talking about the incident here in Washington State, Seattle. And I was just in the International District where they said that happened. I just came through the station there yesterday. That's right downtown. Tell everybody, avoid downtown. Like, you've got to go to Seattle. Don't go downtown. It's super dangerous. All of that, everywhere downtown. But in the report where she said she didn't want to think that way, that they don't want you here and that you're attacked as, you know, some sort of foreign or a non-white person who's unwanted, it has an impact. As he said, Area 8, it has an impact on your brain computer and being able to think logical. And that's exactly what we heard from Johnny Beard, where he said, Jackie Beard, I'm sorry, that's what I'm talking about. Jackie Beard, where he said that it's not a race thing. What do you mean it's not a race thing? He tried to kill you. Maybe because you're with a white person. Same thing that happened here in Seattle. Long history of that, Mr. Beard, or maybe he's not aware. He's a victim. Let's see. Other folks, comments that they want to make sure they get in? Questions, comments, suggestions? While folks are getting, I'll give one more check-in. Also, the segment where they talked about people being upset at the unvaccinated, angered at the unvaccinated, the white male father that they talked to in that report where the family, they got sick after they were vaccinated and went to Disneyland, he cursed and said, you know, and it almost sounded like he was tearing up, choking up. He said, get your damn shot. And I thought, wow, like, this is a public radio report? Like, they don't have cursing of any sort, generally, in public radio. Like, you generally don't have people on there cursing about much of anything. They didn't bleep it out or anything. I thought, wow, like, even to be allowed to speak in that manner is, I don't know. I don't hear Al Sharpton cursing on television or the radio too frequently. I don't know how people would respond to that, or President Obama, Michelle Obama, Serena Williams. Like, I don't know how people would respond to that. That's one. But just for that to be allowed, to have that sort of outrage directed at so-called unvaccinated, like, wow, that just, to me, that stands out as very significant. Anywho, invest if you think the program is constructive. Listener-supported counter-racist radio. Hit the blog, racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. PayPal button is in the top right corner. We are also at Cash App. The address, cash.app/$ the cows. Huge thanks to all of the investors who have kept the cows on the air for 12 plus years. Hopefully we have been worthy of your time and energy, especially in the midst of the so-called pandemic, where you can be investing in toilet paper or ammunition, all kinds of things, water. Hopefully we have been especially relevant, generally accurate over the past year and a half, 2 years or so. You can also hit the Amazon wish list. I think I already got my replacement battery, so we should be good there. But the external sound card, that little like $7 gadget, that would be awesome as well, just to make sure that I am straight for broadcasting needs for the upcoming week. We should be here Thursday at minimum for the book club with Woody Flippin' Allen. They mentioned Jeffrey Epstein in the report, and Governor Cuomo also right there in New York. Jeffrey Epstein was right there in New York. These folks are probably all homies. Man,
I'm so eager to read. We haven't even got to the part. Like I said, it might take a while, this book, to get to where he actually, oh, yes. Now, how did Sidney Previn get in the picture and the adoption and all that? It might take a while. I don't even know if he's going to get to it this week. This will be our third segment. But we're reading this book. What is white culture? What does it mean to be white? That's why we're reading this text to begin with. Man, the first two sections are in the archives. Check it out. I'm super looking forward to Thursday. Check Black Talk Radio Network, Facebook for updates for upcoming programs, seeing if we can get some other white people on as we move through the end of the summer 2021. Again, cannot emphasize enough, there's been just so much random violence. Emphasize safety. It has been super unsafe for Gus T, but as much as you can, emphasize safety with what you're doing and try not to put yourself in risky environments. I would say emphasize that if you have offspring and just telling them to really think about safety. It is so unsafe in so many ways and just random violence. That's the thing, like where it's not like you did something or you have an ongoing vendetta with someone, just random, unprovoked violence where it's nothing that you can do other than try as best you can to be in safe areas around safe people, and if it looks like things are heading towards something unsafe, exit. Get out of there as soon as possible. Err on the side of caution. I was saying when I was stumbling and fumbling and couldn't really discern, is this fireworks? Is this gunfire at the park? Err on the side of caution. You'd much rather be fooled. It was fireworks, and they fooled me and made me get up and get out of there, and oh, okay, it was just fireworks. You would much rather have that than the other way. Err on the side of safety for the considerable future. Other comments folks wanted to make sure they got in. Questions, observations. Everybody satisfied? Anything else they want to make sure they get in? Are they all good for the week? We'll assume everybody is satisfied. I did watch the Untold, or the documentary called Untold, Malice in the Palace. There were a lot of documentaries that came out dealing with racism, white supremacy this week. It is still, reading is more important than watching television. But there were a number of documentaries that came out related to racism, white supremacy. That might even be another component of entertainment moving forward, to just make lots and lots of documentaries about white supremacy, racism, and or television programs, and I think they call them docudramas, where they get added. Disconnected for the fifth time. Fifth time. Disconnected. Tech issues abound. My goodness. Usual suspects. At any rate, we'll be here minimum on Thursday for the book club. As I said, you can check Facebook, Black Talk Radio Network, the other social media outlets for the upcoming live programs, hopefully. The program worthy of your time and energy. I was saying as I got disrupted, I was able to see the documentary film, Untold, Malice at the Palace. There were a lot of documentaries that came out this week that were about racism, white supremacy, and some even docudramas where they make up and add some lies into a report or event that did actually happen, but they're not going to just tell you the truth. They got to make up some fiction, lies, and put that in for entertainment purposes. But even with that documentary, and I learned quite a bit, and this is about the brawl between the Indiana Pacers and Detroit Pistons back in 2004, Ron Artest at the center of all of this black male, talk about black misandry, that even there, they don't mention the term racism in the documentary. They mention race. They mention how it's black males. He got accused in this melee, and they talk about, like, wow, we got all of this alcohol fueled rage and folks trespassing on the court to go attack these black males, and the word thug used a lot, but the word racism, certainly not white supremacy, nowhere in the documentary, which of course, what are we talking about, but racism, white supremacy, and even connecting this to the lots of rules that were changed in the NBA. This is when they changed the rules so it could be no more black 18-year-olds coming directly to the NBA. They outlawed that, and then they put in the dress code, like you all got to wear suits and ties and all the rest of it. No more of your Negro thug paraphernalia to our NBA games. Like,
no mention of white supremacy racism directly, although that's exactly what it is. And in fact, they even talked about how much control, power, not privilege, power white people have, that there was so much video of this brawl that erupted in Michigan. It wasn't even in Detroit. The Detroit Pistons, they play in Auburn Hills, which is a suburb of Detroit. The metaphor that they use, tackiness, white flight. White people aren't even in Detroit. They're in the outskirts of the town. So the Detroit Pistons playing in Auburn Hills, that's where this fight happened at. They had so many different camera angles and video footage to go in and prosecute exactly what happened in this incident. But they said, I think Jermaine O'Neal and some of the other black NBA athletes, former players, were involved in putting this project together. But they said that the NBA, white people who run the NBA, they owned the rights to the footage of this brawl. So they had to go to them to get permission to include this footage in the documentary. That is fine. I mean, that it might have even been contingent. We'll allow you to use the video footage as long as the word racism is nowhere in this documentary. White power, not privilege. Hope the cows was worthy of your time and energy this evening, especially because it was so difficult. Like, man, with every tech issues and all the rest of it, like, wow. Anywho, we'll be back on Thursday, hopefully, with no issues, no tech issues at least, and continue towards solving the problem. Sobriety would be best. Many of these different instances of attacks and assaults and what have you, Alice at the Palace, as it's called, alcohol, front and center. We need fully functioning brain computers to solve our problems. In addition to being sober, if you're going to go out and about, they reported Jonathan Patrick Leary, I believe is the white male's name, sideswiped a victim, did the Nazi salute, attacked a black motorist, and then said he wanted to kill 60, 70 people, and they only got 30 seconds worth of reporting on that. That's what you should be thinking, like, wow, traveling out and about, like, very dangerous times. If someone is being hostile and loud, you do not want to be verbally confronting strangers. You should be thinking, this person could be armed. What we heard, unknown from unknown galaxy, this person could be armed, all kinds of dangerous. They could be prepared, looking forward to the opportunity to kill right now. If you didn't leave your residence, like, prepared to kill and die immediately. Exit. You do not want to be confronting someone who has, in fact, they might even have a whole entourage of armed race soldiers ready. They've been training for this moment. In addition to being sober and alert, if you're going to be driving, you are not on the cell phone. We're trying to do the small things to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no, and we need all of our attention. That said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
No problem. You're a victim.
Yeah. I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.